Hello there, and welcome to episode number 134 of Blue Jays World Update. I'm your host, Thomas Hall, and let's get you up to date. My, oh my, we've got some catching up to do. Like, seriously. It's been a hot minute since we had some real juicy things to talk about, but my goodness, two massive developments transpired between the last time we spoke. That being, one, Shohei Ohtani is now a Los Angeles Dodger, which isn't surprising by any means. Disappointing, but not surprising. And then also, something that has been largely overshadowed to this point because of Ohtani and the hype behind him, and that's Juan Soto being traded to the New York Yankees in a deal that we'll get into a little bit. I'm still not entirely convinced the Yankees as a whole are better from this trade. They're without a doubt drastically better offensively, but given the amount of pitching they surrendered, the fact that their defense is now slightly worse than it was before the trade for Soto and the trade for Alex Verdugo. So we're going to dive into all that. We're going to look at some areas where the Blue Jays can turn to now that Soto and Ohtani are off the market, and see where this team could and should pivot next, even though realistically, no matter what they do from here on out for the rest of the offseason, it's going to feel like a letdown compared to the possibility of adding a player of Ohtani's caliber, or even Soto as well. And that's a good point to start at here, and that's with, you know, let's start with Ohtani here, because he's the bigger star, and there was a lot more drama involved in the entire process, especially with how things played out on the Blue Jays end, and how insane things got for 48 hours during that period. Where, now let's take everyone back to last Friday, and I wanted to do an emergency podcast sooner than this, but I just didn't have the time. So we're gonna have to go back a little bit, almost a week now, which is crazy. But let's go back to last Friday and start with the morning, right? Friday morning. We're all kind of waiting patiently for any sort of little tidbit to come out about whether or not there's any sort of inclination as to when Ohtani may make his final decision and announcement. Little did we know that that would come the next day. And John Morosi kind of kicks things off by reporting that Ohtani's decision could come as early as Friday. Sends a jolt through the entire baseball world, especially the Blue Jays, because you go back even further to the start of the winter meetings, and it gets all crazy with Ross Atkins having to change his in-person media availability to a Zoom call almost at the last minute, and John Schneider had to push his a day later. And then later that night, it's revealed, or at least reported, that Ross Atkins couldn't arrive in Nashville on time for the winter meetings because he was in Dunedin meeting with Shohei Ohtani and his representatives. And so it showed how much mutual interest there was between the two parties, which when you go go back to last Friday, it's like, okay, like, you know, the Dodgers and the Blue Jays are the two finalists here, or at least it seemed like it. You know, looking back on it now, it's probably more likely that the Dodgers were right in there alongside the Blue Jays and the Dodgers as well. And so, you know, you have that anticipation of an announcement possibly coming, you know, very shortly. And then all the rumors start about Ohtani being on that flight from Southern California to Toronto, the one, you know, almost everyone tracked across North America. And then the internet sleuthing continued with, you know, looking into the fact that Yusei Kikuchi had dinner reservations set in Toronto. And, you know, the connections between Ohtani and Kikuchi, it's like, yeah, you can, you know, try and connect the dots there. And it continues even further with that report out of Los Angeles saying that, you know, Ohtani has chosen the Blue Jays over the Dodgers, which was not the case. And even though it came from a credentialed reporter who was part of the Baseball Writers of America Association, still didn't mean anything. John Morosi comes out, says Ohtani's actually on that flight to Toronto, which was not the case. It was furthest thing from the truth, actually. And, you know, short story short, the Blue Jays were let down. And, you know, the next day, after the Jays are reeling, or at least the Blue Jays fan base is reeling from the fiasco that was the day prior, Ohtani announces his decision on Instagram, of all places, because of course he does, and posts a picture of the Dodgers logo and makes his announcement over on a 10-year, $700 million contract, which isn't even the craziest thing. You know, the fact that $680 million of that $700 million contract is deferred from 10 years from now. And that the fact that Ohtani is going to make just $2 million a year in on-field revenue over his 10-year contract with the Dodgers, which is totally fine because he makes $40 to $50 million in endorsements and off-field revenue. So he's going to be perfectly fine. You know, the only downside is that $680 million isn't going to collect any sort of interest. So when he's collecting that $68 million check every year for the 10 years after his deal expires, it'll still be $68 million. But, you know, I'm no accountant, but it sounds like he'll get some tax breaks in California by having his contract deferred like that, which, you know, may work out to his benefit. Rather than getting $70 million per year, it'll help the Dodgers a little bit when it comes to the luxury tax too, but not as much as, you know, people think it will, just by looking at the fact that he's going to make just $2 million in real money. Major League Baseball views his contract, even though $680 million is deferred, he'll still be looked at as a $46 million player over the 10-year of his deal. So in reality, it's like a 10-year, $460 million contract, even though it's not going to be paid like that. That's what it will show in the Dodgers' payroll. So, you know, it does give them a little bit of financial flexibility to do other moves, like sign Yoshinobu Yamamoto, or go out and acquire Tyler Glasnow via trade. And when you think about it too, it's like, even though the Dodgers will have that $46 million hit on their competitive balance tax payroll, and that will increase the luxury tax penalty that they will ultimately pay, because they're only giving $2 million to Ohtani. They essentially can use those savings and pay off whatever luxury tax penalties they get. So it kind of offsets, which is why it was Ohtani's idea to structure his contract like that. And not to mention, too, to add in that wrinkle that, and it's a very big wrinkle, that if controlling owner Mark Walter or president of baseball operations Andrew Friedman lose their roles with the team at any point throughout Ohtani's 10-year contract, he can opt out, which essentially makes both of those guys untouchable, right? Like, none of the other owners of the Dodgers can even think about, you know, trying to vote Walter out or buy up his shares or whatever the case may be, because he holds so much power with their biggest star. And Andrew Friedman has so much negotiating power now that he basically can negotiate any sort of contract he wants down the line, as long as Ohtani is under contract, because if he goes, Ohtani has the power to go with him. So, you know, that's a pretty substantial little detail to come out of everything. And when you think about it as well, it's like, you think about it from the Blue Jays perspective, and whether or not they would have been willing to sign off on something like that, specifically Rogers Communications, which owns the Blue Jays. Like, would they have been willing to give that sort of controlling power to Edward Rogers or Mark Shapiro, given everything that's gone on with the Blue Jays organization the last few years, with their playoff blunders, and even last season specifically, with just the absolute tire fire that played out after the Blue Jays were eliminated from the wild card series a few months ago, where, you know, there was the PR fire with Ross Atkins's end of season press conference, and everything that transpired with that, the lack of communication that seemingly went on from top to bottom throughout the organization, how Mark Shapiro had to put out the flames of that mess. Like, is that something the Rogers would have been, you know, okay with attaching alongside Edward Rogers or Mark Shapiro? You know, I'm not too sure about that, but clearly the Blue Jays were in this legitimately. And, you know, until we hear from Ross Atkins or Mark Shapiro, we won't know what the Blue Jays offer really looked like. And maybe we'll never know, because I don't think they'll be willing to divulge that type of information. We've seen Ben Nicholson-Smith come out and report that the Blue Jays were right there with the Dodgers. The San Francisco Giants president of baseball operations, Farhan Zaidi, spoke the other day and said that he had an identical offer on the table for Ohtani. So, you know, in the end, it really doesn't matter anymore. Ultimately, like, Shohei chose the Dodgers, and I think that was going to be a really challenging job for any team to deter him from ending up with the Dodgers, just because it made so much sense for Ohtani to stay in Los Angeles that it was just, it wasn't an impossible task, but at the same time, there was so much going for the Dodgers, it was really going to be extremely difficult for any team, specifically the Blue Jays, to convince Ohtani that it made sense for him to sign with Canada's team, even though it would have brought him a lot more opportunities, specifically off the field, right? And you know, I think that one of the worst things to come out about this, actually, there's a couple of things, but two things that I've focused on here is, one, the lack of due diligence and credibility that's transpired here for journalism, right? You have two baseball reporters, credentialed baseball reporters, that blatantly got things wrong. And both of them, sure, they've since put out apologies. Took them long enough to do so in the first place, but they did it. But neither of them will face any real ramifications other than losing credibility on Twitter or X. You know, neither of them will lose their jobs. They're still credentialed, so they still get to go to games, talk to players, talk to coaches, be in the bowels of stadiums. Nothing changes for them in that regard. While baseball fans, especially Blue Jays fans, they're the real victims in all this. And another thing to bounce off of that topic, it was incredibly disappointing that the Blue Jays organization didn't do anything, that we know of at least, to try and defuse the situation that transpired last Friday. You know, like Farhan Zaidi in particular said that he knew from the very moment that Ohtani wasn't on that plane, and that he reached out to Ohtani's camp and found out that that was the case. The Blue Jays surely would have done the same. And so, in my mind, it's like, okay, if they knew that Ohtani wasn't on the plane, why wouldn't they have leaked something to, whether it was somebody on the Blue Jays beat or a national reporter, just so that everything could have gone to a place of calmness again, rather than everyone losing their mind? Essentially, all of Canada was focused on Shohei Ohtani on Friday. Not just baseball fans, not just the city of Toronto, like all of Canada. You know, like, it was wild. It was pandemonium for a good 3-4 hours. And it's just like, the Jays could have limited this letdown had Friday not gotten so out of hand the way it did. That's the bigger issue I have with all of it right now. And it is what it is. Like, it's over and done with now. There's nothing we can do to change it. But the Blue Jays are now in an impossible situation where, again, like I said off the top, doesn't matter what they do for the rest of the offseason, in most fans' opinions, it won't be good enough because they were in discussion for Ohtani and Soto. And it gives off this notion that, like, you know, again, you're left as the bridesmaid rather than being the bride at the wedding, right? You know, you're left at the altar. Again, that's not the truth behind how the Blue Jays have operated the last few years, right? They have been successful at landing marquee free agents, right? Like Kevin Gausman, George Springer, convincing Jose Berríos to sign a 7-year extension just 2 months after being traded for, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many different examples. But, you know, again, it's incredibly heartbreaking when you're not able to. It's incredibly heartbreaking when you invest so much time, so many resources into a player like Ohtani, and you think you're on the edge, you're on the verge of acquiring him. You know, you think everything is lining up for Ohtani to sign with the Blue Jays, and then it all falls apart so quickly, right? And now the Blue Jays are like, damn, you know, how do we pivot here? Because the position player market, both in free agency and via trade, beyond Shohei Ohtani and Juan Soto, is pretty damn bleak. Right, the free agent position player market has been well documented thus far. It's not good, right? And you know, luckily the Blue Jays didn't miss out on many possibilities while they were investing time in Ohtani. Like, for those who think they missed an opportunity to acquire Juan Soto, like John Heyman, who likes to have smoke blown up his ass a lot of the time. It's just not true. The Jays had no shot at acquiring Juan Soto, looking at what the Yankees gave up for him. The Blue Jays would not have been able to come anywhere close to that type of offer from a pitching standpoint. It's foolish and irrational to think the Jays could have made a compelling offer to match what the Yankees were offering. You know, like, obviously the Blue Jays were interested in Soto, but I don't care if you offer up Alek Manoah and Ricky Tiedemann. The Yankees offer probably still beats that. Now, that being said, they can always try and play the long game with Soto, who's a Scott Boras client, so there's a good chance he goes to free agency after next season, and at that point the Blue Jays can revisit all of this and you know, they've already laid the groundwork, you know, to show that they have interest in Soto, and assuming they don't hand out a lucrative deal to Cody Bellinger, which is entirely possible. And I'll get into the reasons again, just briefly touch on why I don't love that move unless it's at a much lower cost. You know, if the Blue Jays weren't to end up with Cody Bellinger, you know, they'd have a spot in left field for a Juan Soto in 2025 if he doesn't extend with the Yankees. But speaking of Cody Bellinger, he now, without question, is the top remaining bat available in free agency. And by the sounds of it, again, bringing up Heyman, who reported on Wednesday that it seems like the Blue Jays and the Cubs are the two front runners for Cody Bellinger. And obviously there's prior history between the Cubs and Bellinger's camp, right? He enjoyed a resurgent year in Chicago this past season, and has set himself up very nicely, especially considering that Shohei's now off the market, and there are a lot of teams who are desperate to still add offense, like the Blue Jays. But there are a lot of red flags associated with Bellinger. Namely, the fact that he doesn't generate much hard contact. He got pretty lucky throughout the 2023 season. He outperformed his expected metrics by a large margin. And he's got that injury history with his shoulder. You know, so I would be incredibly hesitant to give a 28-year-old player a $200 to $250 million contract. Now, there's a good chance that a lot of teams are hesitant to do so, and that the price on Bellinger could drop. And if it dips down closer to $150 million over say 7 or 8 years, I could get on board with that, right? Because then that comes out to, you know, low 20s million dollars per year, you know, 21, 22 million dollar player. I could get on board with that type of contract, because even then, like, if he regresses like it's expected he will, you'll still receive top-notch defense in the outfield. You know, he'll still be, or at least he should still be, an above replacement level player, right? Like, a few Fangraphs projections right now have him at a 2.5 win player next season. You know, I'll take that at 21, 22 million dollars per year. You know, if we get closer to 30 million, that's when I would be out on Bellinger. You know, I think if it gets up to that high, which it very well could, considering he's repped by Scott Boras, that's where I would have a lot of pause with Bellinger, because I like him. You know, I was really impressed with the way he bounced back in 2023, but I'm still very uneasy. I feel very uneasy about handing him a $200 million contract. I would not be on board with something like that. Especially when, like, there are likely better options via trade available than giving Bellinger $200 million or more. Specifically somebody like a Max Kepler from Minnesota, who will only make $10 million next season, is somebody realistically would check more boxes offensively for the Blue Jays than somebody like Cody Bellinger. Because, you know, unlike Bellinger, Max Kepler is somebody who has a much more proven track record of producing power. You know, it was funny looking back a few years ago, well, a number of years ago actually now, where after Max Kepler's breakout year in 2019, where he crushed 36 home runs, 90 RBIs, posted a 267 isolated power, 519 slugging percentage, a 122 WRC plus, and was nearly a four-win player. I tweeted out a few different times how Max Kepler would fit beautifully on the Blue Jays that offseason. And, you know, here we are 4 years later, kind of talking about the same thing. Now, he didn't have as good of a year, at least in the power department, as he did in 2019, but Max Kepler would still make a ton of sense for the Blue Jays. Left-handed bat, sure, he's only 1 year away from free agency, but he hit 24 home runs last year, 66 RBIs, produced a 224 ISO, 484 slug, 124 WRC plus. Now, the fit in the outfield wouldn't be perfect, because he's largely played right field, which could necessitate moving George Springer to left field, which, you know, like, I don't think that'd be daunting for Springer. I mean, he's played center field and right field in his career, you know, like, sure, left field would be an adjustment, but I don't think that's something he wouldn't be able to accomplish. And Max Kepler's been, you know, a pretty well-regarded defender in right field throughout his career. You know, across almost 6,600 innings, he's recorded 48 defensive runs saved and 54 outs above average in right. You know, the numbers weren't as good in 2023, like just a +2 DRS and a +4 OAA over 972 and a third innings. But the power is what really sticks out to me, and also the fact that Kepler is somebody who generates a lot of hard contact, barrels up balls, you know, has really encouraging expected numbers along with all of that as well. So, and the fact that the Twins, because of their uncertain TV deal with Bally Sports, they're looking to shed salary. And, you know, Max Kepler at $10 million, that's somebody they absolutely should be looking to part with. And when you look at it from the Blue Jays perspective, he's somebody that probably could be fairly easy to acquire, not all that expensive. And it's like, if you're balancing between giving Cody Bellinger like $25 to $30 million per season, or giving up a few assets to go get a $10 million player like Max Kepler, that's a pretty easy decision, right? So, you know, that's one possibility. Ultimately, where I kind of stand in all of this is, I think the Blue Jays are going to have to do a combination of both free agency and trades, sort of like how they did last year, but to a much more higher degree on the position player side, right? When you look at the free agents that the Blue Jays signed on the position player side last winter, you know, it was Kevin Kiermaier, Brandon Belt, you know, like, valuable guys, right? Like, both were pretty important to the Blue Jays' success during the regular season, especially Kevin Kiermaier in the outfield, and what Brandon Belt did for you offensively. Even though he didn't provide much power, he was still one of their better hitters per WRC plus. So, you know, but they need to aim a little bit higher, especially from a power department. And so, you know, because there aren't a lot of attractive options left in free agency, that's where I think they're probably going to have to do a mix and match sort of thing, where, you know, like, say for one example, maybe they pick up a Rhys Hoskins in free agency, or Jorge Soler, and then they go out and they acquire, you know, a Max Kepler from Minnesota, or a Jorge Polanco from the Twins, or you go to the Brewers and maybe consider a Willy Adames, who is in the or is going to be entering the final year of his club control. He's going to command a projected $12.4 million in his final year of arbitration. So with the Brewers in a similar position as the Twins, they're also looking to shed salary, and I don't think they're going to be able to retain Adames after this season. At least all indications suggest they won't be able to. So, you know, maybe you go out and get a bat like Hoskins or Soler, and then you trade for a bat like Adames. And while you're talking to the Brewers, maybe you ask about Christian Yelich too, because, you know, his name has come up in the rumor mill recently, thanks to, you know, our old friend John Heyman, who, you know, loves to talk out of both sides of his mouth. But he brought up on Wednesday that the Blue Jays have kicked around the idea of making a run at Christian Yelich. And, you know, there would be advantages and disadvantages to doing that. You know, one of the obvious downsides of making a move like that is because the amount of term left on Yelich's deal, like, he's signed through 2028 at $26 million per season, and he has a $20 million mutual option in 2029 that comes with a $6.5 million buyout. Now, if you're the Blue Jays, you probably hope the Brewers are willing to eat, you know, $3 to $6 million worth of that contract, which essentially would make Christian Yelich a $20 million player over the next five seasons at least, which would be far more feasible for the Blue Jays, because, you know, like, Christian Yelich had a pretty respectable bounce back year this past season. And even though he's somebody who doesn't hit for much power anymore, and is, you know, basically average defensively in the outfield, he's still a quality hitter, somebody that you could put in your, you know, number six, number five spot, who would, you know, improve the Blue Jays offense considerably next season. And if you were to, you know, add a Yelich and an Adames, in addition to, you know, whether it's a Rhys Hoskins or a Jorge Soler, now you have the makings of a really intriguing offense, because, you know, you get that middle of the order power in a Soler or a Hoskins, and then you can add a Willy Adames behind that mix. Same thing with Christian Yelich. You could even potentially flirt with the idea of putting Christian Yelich in the top half of the order and putting a left-handed bat in between, say, Bo and Vladdy, and have Bo lead off and Yelich hit two, Vladdy three, something like that, just to balance things out a little bit. And Yelich gets on base fairly consistently as well. So, you know, that would put a runner on base, you know, in front of Vladdy consistently. So, but obviously when you look at Christian Yelich, you think of, you know, the recent declines, the fact that he's 32 years old, you know, but I think it would all come down to how desperate the Brewers are to shed some money. Because if they're looking to move a big contract, like, there's no better option than Yelich, right? But it's also like, okay, like, where do they fall on the scale, right? Like, do they want to retain as little salary as possible on a deal like Yelich, which would limit the Brewers' return for him? And if you're the Blue Jays, would you be like, okay, we're willing to eat the majority of that remaining salary, but you've got to give us Willy Adames too, right? Like, there's a lot of different ways the Blue Jays could go with that. But that would be one advantage to taking on a contract like Yelich, is you get a short-term addition like Adames, who could fill in at second base, even though he's been a shortstop for the majority of his career, or all of his career, essentially. You know, but that would not only give you an option at second base, it would also free up Santiago Espinal and being able to make him expendable, because then you have a player like Adames who, if something happened to Bichette, could fill in regularly at shortstop, and you're not left scrambling like the Blue Jays were last season when Bo went down due to injury. So, you know, Kepler and Adames are two players that I would have circled on my, you know, trade targets if I were the Blue Jays. You could also look to the Chicago White Sox as well. They're an intriguing team, right? Like, the Blue Jays, I don't think, have a ton of interest in Dylan Cease, and rightly so, because of the return heel command and the fact that, you know, he's only got 2 years left before he becomes eligible for free agency. And if you're the Blue Jays, like, sure, you could go gangbusters and just get another frontline starter similar to the Yoshinobu Yamamoto conversation, but unlike with Cease, the Blue Jays wouldn't have to give up any prospects to make that happen, which is why they, you know, are seriously, or they seem to be seriously interested in a player like Yamamoto, which could then allow them to trade Alek Manoah for a bat or two. And so, you know, even though they're likely not on the Dylan Cease conversation, there are two bats on the White Sox roster who they should absolutely be calling about. And that's one, Eloy Jimenez, who, you know, would be a full-time DH, like similar to the Brandon Belt type role, except reverse, where you use Jimenez versus lefties, and probably not much against righties, but he'd be an option for that too. And he's, you know, given his remaining contract, where, you know, he's going to make $13.8 million next season. He's got two club options, The years after, 16.5 million in 2025, 18.5 in 2026. Pretty inexpensive buyouts in those as well, $3 million each. And with the fact that the White Sox are entering a rebuild, that's somebody who probably you could acquire easily, given the fact that Jimenez really hasn't impressed all that much over the last few years. And, you know, he's more of a platoon hitter at this point of his career, which is, you know, it's certainly disappointing considering the strong start that he had to his career, particularly his rookie season, where he broke into the league and mashed 31 home runs in 122 games, and then followed that up with a shortened 2022 year, but had 14 home runs, 263 ISO, 559 slugging with a 138 WRC plus, and has, you know, really never been the same type of guy since those first 2 years. And, you know, 2023, he was okay. You know, I think the disappointment around the White Sox, particularly the issues they had inside their clubhouse, may have had a lot to do with his disappointing season, where, you know, he missed the 20 home run mark again. You know, 169 ISO, a 441 slug, a 105 WRC plus. He only can DH now, really. Like, I would not put him in the outfield whatsoever. You know, just a major liability defensively. So, you know, $13.8 million. If the Blue Jays were to miss out on Hoskins and Soler, Jimenez could look like a pretty appealing option. But while we're on the topic of the White Sox, we got to talk about Luis Robert Jr. Because if the Blue Jays could acquire him, that would drastically change the outlook of their position player group. Not just from an offensive perspective, but that would make them even more formidable defensively too, because, you know, that could give them essentially three center fielders again. Even though, like, I feel like you'd probably have Dalton Varsho spend a fair bit of time in center too. Like, Luis Robert Jr. is a really good defender too. You know, like, he registered 6 defensive runs saved a year ago, 13 outs above average across just over 1,200 innings in center field, along with the value he provided offensively, where he posted career highs in home runs, RBIs, ISO, slugging percentage. Actually, not slugging percentage, because 2021 he had a higher clip or slugging percentage, but he was a 5-win player. He was just unbelievable. By far the White Sox best player, like, top to bottom. Maybe second to Dylan Cease, but easily their best hitter by a large margin. And that's why, you know, I'm hesitant to say that he'd be able, or the Blue Jays would be able to procure his services, especially considering the fact that he's not close to free agency. He's under, or he signed through 2025 at a very team-friendly $12 million, $12.5 million in 2024, $15 million in 2025, and he has two $20 million club options in 2026 and 2027. So essentially, you have 4 years of control with Robert, who's just 26 years old. So you have him through, you know, his age 30 season. And, you know, from everything that's come out of Chicago right now, it doesn't sound like they're motivated to move him, and rightly so. Like, do you want to move a player like that, who could still be a part of your, you know, your competitive window in 4 or 5 years, depending on how long this rebuild lasts for the White Sox. But they're essentially tearing this down to the studs, right? Like, it's gonna be a good minute until the White Sox are competitive again. And, you know, it could be sooner, given the fact that the AL Central is just this muddying mess of mediocrity, where, like, considering the Kansas City Royals are just, you know, suddenly starting to sign players, specifically pitchers, they could just quietly emerge as a division threat next season. Like, that's how bad the AL Central is. Especially when, like, teams like the Twins and the Guardians are having to shed salary. That could open the door for a team like the Royals, where, like, if you're the White Sox, you're looking at all this and you're seeing the Guardians and the Twins still probably at the top fighting for a division title, the Royals not far behind, or at least they might not be far behind by the end of this offseason. Whatever the hell the Tigers end up being, where does that leave you? Like, that leaves you at the bottom of the pack, right? And so with all that factored in the equation, maybe we're looking at, like, 2028, 2029, maybe even 2030, by the time the White Sox are relevant again. And at that point, like, Luis Robert's in his 30s. He's at the end of his current contract at that point. So, looking at all that, in my mind at least, I don't think a deal for Robert is completely off the table. But it would take a lot. It would take a lot to get Robert from the White Sox. Like, I think in my mind, Alan Rodon would have to be included in the deal. Like, there'd be no package to talk about if his name wasn't included in it, I think. And it would probably have to be some sort of combination of Rodon, Martinez, you know, like Chad Dallas maybe. The Ricky Tiedemann's not getting traded. Like, I don't see any scenario where the Blue Jays trade him. But the Jays don't have a lot of marquee names in their system. So I don't know if they have the pieces, or at least are willing to put up the pieces to make that sort of trade. And if they did, like, that would leave their remaining farm system in a really vulnerable position, more than it already is in. That being said, you add a player of Luis Robert Jr.'s caliber to the Blue Jays offense, you put him next to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in that offense, man, that would be pretty potent. And not only would it help them over the next 2 years, but again, with Luis Robert having two club options, it would also extend the Blue Jays' competitive window a little bit. And that's something to keep an eye on here as we move forward, because, you know, obviously had the Blue Jays signed Ohtani, that would have given them a 10-year competitive window, right? That 10-year window where no matter what, you have to do everything possible to give yourself a chance to make the playoffs and compete for a World Series. As things stand right now, with Bo and Vladdy eligible to hit free agency after the 2025 season, the Blue Jays haven't done anything to extend their 2-year window. They could obviously change that narrative by extending one of, if not both, of Bichette and Guerrero this offseason. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's certainly possible. But if they make some moves that extend beyond the 2025 season, like acquiring a Robert Jr. or a Cody Bellinger or a Christian Yelich, that would give us a little bit of an indication as to where the Blue Jays stand on their current competitive window and how they view it beyond 2025. Because outside of Bellinger, there's no other position players that are going to extend that window for you. It's not going to happen. The players aren't available. Like, no disrespect to old friends, Teoscar Hernandez, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Matt Chapman. I'm just not going to be convinced that the Blue Jays are announcing their competitive window is extending beyond these 2 years by signing, you know, anyone from that, you know, third tier free agent market. So, you know, I think barring a Bellinger move or, you know, a Yelich acquisition or a Robert acquisition or even, you know, a Jose Ramirez acquisition, even though he's got a full no-trade clause like Christian Yelich does too, probably doesn't want to leave Cleveland, even though that would certainly help their financial situation. I'm not convinced that the Blue Jays are going to make any sort of significant move to extend that competitive window at this point. Again, barring those other type of deals that could come to fruition, I think it's more realistically, and I know this isn't something that the fan base wants to hear because it's not a sexy pivot from Ohtani and Soto, is that they go out and make short-term additions, right? Like a Rhys Hoskins, a Jorge Soler, you know, in the outfield, like a Michael A. Taylor maybe, or Joey Gallo, or Adam Duvall, or Robbie Grossman, or Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, or Tommy Pham. You know, players of that caliber that are really only going to help you during this two-year window, you know, could help you maximize it, but nowhere near as much as some of the other top names that you could have had and are still, you know, up for grabs potentially outside of a Bellinger. So it's interesting. You know, the one X factor in all of this is Yoshinobu Yamamoto. I think at least, because, like, that dude looks like a stud. You know, the pitch arsenal, the makeup, the stats speak for themselves. The fact that he's 25 years old, he's going to garner probably a $250 to $300 million contract, if not more, because of how young he is and established he is. And at this point, I think it's probably a little too late for the Blue Jays to make any sort of noise in the Yamamoto sweepstakes. But the reason why I bring it up as an X factor is because if you sign him and you add a frontline starter of his caliber to the mix of Gausman, Berríos, Bassett, and Kikuchi, and then you go ahead and trade Alek Manoah for some more offensive support. And, you know, you could still add in free agency too, right? Like, you could still go out and add a Rhys Hoskins or a Jorge Soler, even though you signed a Yamamoto, right? Neither of those guys are going to cost too much. You know, right? Like, Rhys Hoskins may look for a two-year deal. And Jorge Soler is coming off a, like, one of the best seasons of his career, but he's largely a DH, right? Like, he's going to be like a $12 to $15 million player per year, right? Like, he's probably looking at a deal somewhere in the neighborhood of a Condelario's, maybe. Like, maybe a three-year, $45 million contract, possibly. Be a lot for a DH, but he gives you a ton of power, right? So, we'll see, but I know the Blue Jays are primarily focused on hitting and specifically slugging. But man, it's very tempting to fantasize about a rotation that includes Yamamoto, Gausman, Bassett, and Berríos, and Kikuchi as your number five. That's, whew. You know, the Blue Jays already have a really good pitching staff, a really good starting rotation, especially if Alek Manoah were to bounce back and look closer to the 2022 version of himself rather than 2023. But Yamamoto could make it even more lethal. And, you know, if you're gonna, if Cody Bellinger is going to warrant $200 million, I know that's not something you would give him if you're the Blue Jays, or at least you shouldn't give him if you're the Blue Jays. If you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound, you might as well go after Yamamoto. But again, I think that's unrealistic at this point. I think it's much more likely he goes to, like, say, the Dodgers, considering they also have Ohtani now, Yamamoto's former teammate, his fellow countryman. That makes a lot more sense, especially considering the Dodgers have more money to spend. The Yankees also seem heavily involved. The Mets, too. So, you know, the Giants would make a lot of sense for Yamamoto as well. So I kind of see the Blue Jays as a long shot in the Yamamoto sweepstakes. But if they were to get Cody Bellinger on, you know, more of a friendlier contract, you know, like I said, like closer to $150 million over 7 or 8 years, I could get behind that more. And it would, you know, theoretically improve their offense a fair bit. Not, you know, it wouldn't push them over the edge in the power department, but, you know, there are other options that they could further enhance their team's ability in that regard. So, we'll see how things progress moving forward here, but I think the main thing to focus on here is that even though it's still heartbreaking that the Blue Jays didn't get Ohtani or Soto, and it doesn't seem like anything they do moving forward here will be good enough. That's totally valid. I'm not here to try and convince you any otherwise. But this team can still get better from where it finished last year. That's the important thing. And they still have several potential avenues available to them. Nothing outside of, again, Soto and Ohtani is closed off from them. Right? I think I wrote over 1,700 words earlier this week outlining all the potential trade possibilities they could have. I didn't even have time to mention in this episode they could potentially call up Los Angeles and ask about Mike Trout. Right? It's unrealistic, especially because Mike Trout has a full no trade clause, and as of now, it doesn't seem like he wants out, and the Angels seem like they want to try and be competitive. I don't know how long that will last, because their team right now ain't looking all that great, especially in that AL West division. So we'll see where things head there, but if Mike Trout's available, the Blue Jays absolutely should be doing everything they can to try and acquire him. So, you know, still, I won't be shocked if the Blue Jays, again, do a combination of things, both free agency and via trade. Maybe it's not as significant as a trade as, you know, say last year's Teoscar Hernandez and the deal that sent Lourdes Gurriel Jr. and Gabby Moreno to Arizona. Maybe it's not of that type of magnitude, But I do think we'll see this team being active in the trade market, especially after Cody Bellinger signs, whether that's with the Blue Jays or somewhere else. I think once his name comes off the free agent market, that's when, you know, we could see the floodgates open more intensely, especially because, you know, the indication was that things would start to move once Ohtani came off the market, and they have slowly, but, you know, with a weak free agent class on the position player side, trades could come, you know, start coming through the transaction wire once a player like Bellinger comes off the board. And then, you know, hopefully that's when things start to get a little bit more crazier, because up to this point, it's been a little bit of a snooze fest thus far. So we'll see where things turn. But until that time, I'm your host, Thomas Hall, and now you're up to date. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.